The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cutaneous Manifestations of Systemic Disease, Parts 1 and 2, is presented by Dr. Richard Darrow.
Okay, I should say right up front that this lecture starts with the head and neck and goes right down to the toes. As you know, the dermatological system is the biggest system of the body, so it does have a lot of tip-offs to various diseases. You're not going to see every one of these things that are on the slide, but there is an association between what I've picked and things they ask on the board. So actually, although some of these are esoteric, they're all important in the sense that they do have some reference to board examination questions. Okay, you've already heard the discussion of temporal arteritis. Just know, and this is a lot of these things I'll say are repeating what's been given before, and what I say will also be repeated by future lectures, because this kind of covers the whole field of internal medicine through the skin. In terms of temporal arteritis, know that if there's a question on FUO, temporal arteritis is often one of the answers, or the giant cell arteritis complex, which may include aortitis and even elevated liver enzymes. It all depends on where the inflammation of the vessel is. But it is a giant cell arteritis. Again, it's often a cause of fever of undetermined origin. Also, it's probably not going to be on the board, but varicella has been connected now. The chickenpox virus has been connected to temporal arteritis. You've already heard reference to the Hutchinson sign. If there's zoster on the nose, then it's probably in the eye, and these people need to be referred to the ophthalmologist. Also note that the first part of this question has to do with the fact that the man missed his shingles vaccine. Again, the age is 60 years old. That's because the vaccine doesn't last long enough, so they recommend not starting it at 50, but starting it at age 60. Whenever you see cellulitis, it has a sharp demarcation. Of course, that's a sign of strep, not staph. Staph usually has a pustule and will be draining yellow pus. Strep won't. It'll show up as this does, as erysipelas. Again, that's a marker for streptococcus. In this case, it was group B strep, so don't be fooled if the strep is not group A. Usually, of course, it is strep pyogenes or group A strep. This is impetigo. You recognize that. The answer, as you can see, is psoriasis. That's because streptococcus is one of those things that will cause a flare-up in psoriasis. It does not cause rheumatic fever. Impetigo does not cause rheumatic fever. It can cause a reactive arthritis, like the HLA-B27 diseases. It also can cause scarlet fever or post-streptococcal GN, but it does not produce rheumatic fever. It takes the regular strep throat to give you rheumatic fever. Antithyroid antibodies were positive on this patient. The point is, if you have a patient with alopecia, it may well be autoimmune with attack against the melanosomes. And if it's autoimmune, the first thing you should look for is Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Of course, the other thing you want to look for is Addison's disease, because you don't want to miss it. If the patient has alopecia and Addison's disease and it's missed, of course, you could end up getting sued. This is a patient with alopecia. He works for the electrical industry. He also has nail changes, like Scott just showed us. And in this case, it could have been arsenic, but in this case, it's thallium because of where he works. The electrical industry, the semiconductor system is connected to thallium toxicity. In this case, the alopecia was due to thallium. Don't forget the heavy metals. They often affect the nervous system, causing paresthesias, and also affect the nails and skin. So whenever there's a symptom like that, symptom complex, consider the heavy metals. This is a woman, she has two mucosal involvements. If you see two mucosal involvements with a rash, especially this type of a rash, then you should think of Steven Johnson syndrome or TEN. I don't think they'd ask it on the board, but you differentiate Steven Johnson's from TEN by the amount of skin involvement. If it's less than 10%, it's usually Steven Johnson's. If it's over 30%, it's usually TEN, toxic epidermal necrolysis. If it's in between 10 and 30%, it's a mix. It could be either one of the two. Oh, by the way, Steven Johnson's and TEN, how do I get back? I guess I go like that. Steven Johnson's and TEN are usually due to drugs, not infections. That's not true of erythema multiforme. But usually if it's Steven Johnson's or TEN, it's almost always drug-related. Everything can cause it, but it's almost always drug-related. Here are the drugs that are connected to it. If it's the Westerners, it's usually oxycam or sulfa. If it's Eastern Oriental, it's usually carbamazepine and allopurinol. That's where you do those HLA-B tests. At any rate, be aware of the two differences in terms of globalism. Okay, this woman has elevated CPK with this rash around the eyes. You recognize this as the heliotrope discoloration that goes along with dermatomyositis. So the patient will have weakness and not pain. So this is a classic example. Remember, if it's a middle-aged male or female and just developed it, it's new onset, then of course you would screen for malignancies. This was pointed out in our prior lectures. This is a patient with rosacea, used to be called acne rosacea. It's probably due to the Demodex mite, because on that mite there's a Bacillus olearinus, which is probably, or at least is conjectured to be one of the causes. It's also been connected to GI bowel flora change. As you know, a change in bowel flora today is taught as producing many things, including diabetes mellitus. So again, the bowel flora, of course, is very important in a whole host of different diseases because it changes the way we respond. This patient has involvement of the eyelid. Of course, that can lead to keratopathy. These patients need to be referred to the eye doctor. These patients usually have flushing because this is a disease characterized by telangiectasia. This is a patient with flushing and watering diarrhea. And of course, the first thing you would consider is carcinoid. So you would do the 5-hydroxyindole acetic acid screen of the urine. There are multiple causes of patients with flushing. I've underlined the ones they may ask on the board, the carcinoid. The mastocytosis may be asked. They have dermatographism. The test you would order for that is the tryptase. Of course, medullary carcinoma, you're familiar with that with the thyrocalcitonin. You probably wouldn't get asked this on the board anymore in terms of scleral perforation. This is called scleromalacia perforans. It was a complication of rheumatoid arthritis in the old days. Obviously, the hands here show the presence of rheumatoid arthritis. This patient would tend to have everything that's listed except, I made an except, even though they don't ask it on the board. In this case, the patient would not have a scarlatiniform rash. The neutropenia, the splenomegaly, of course, has Felty syndrome associated with rheumatoid arthritis. The Kayser-Fleischer ring, you can recognize. I want to say one thing about Wilson's disease, and that is if you get a case of Wilson's disease, what you should know is the alkaline phosphatase is low. As you know, most liver diseases have a high alkaline phosphatase. If you have a liver case and the alkaline phosphatase is low and they have some mental disease, like Bob just mentioned, it may have schizophrenia, et cetera, or some neurological process, you should be thinking of Wilson's disease, because obviously you won't always see the Kayser-Fleischer ring in your practice, because you usually have to send them to the ophthalmologist for slit lamp examination. This patient was working, splashing water in his eye, and of course the green color should tip you off to Pseudomonas. This is the Pseudomonas infection. It can come through the vascular system. In this case, it was external. Obviously, anything green colored makes you think Pseudomonas. If it's yellow colored, it's probably staph. This patient presents with telangiectasia in the eye. This is one of those hereditary autoimmune deficiency syndromes called ataxia telangiectasia. Why should you know it? Because the family is prone to malignancies, and it's important to recognize this so that the family can be screened. These people have a combined immunodeficiency of both B and T cells, and of course, therefore, they're prone to autoimmune diseases. They're also prone to malignancies. This is a patient that had a was in a triathlon and had a two-phase disease. Important, whenever you see a two-phase or three-phase disease, think of spirochetes. In this particular case, the patient has renal and liver involvement, as you can see by the jaundice and the purpura. You can see the spirochetes on the stain. This was eventually diagnosed as leptospirosis. Leptospirosis is one of those spirochetal diseases, as is Lyme disease and syphilis. So again, all of those diseases have two or three phases. Again, if you see a two or three phase disease, don't forget the spirochetes. This patient has the typical xanthelasma of this disease. The patients will complain of itching, and they may have Raynaud's phenomenon. This is primary biliary cirrhosis. Obviously, they have immunoglobulin changes, often a high IgM, and you can have Sjögren syndrome or a lot of other things associated with this, but I don't think you'll miss it if they have the itching and the xanthelasma. Then you obviously have to think of liver and primary biliary cirrhosis. This patient has a B-cell lymphoma. If you ever have anybody that has leukemia or lymphoma, that's a B-cell problem almost always. And when that happens, you know that the B-cells are not working right. They can produce antibodies, and the point is they can produce antibodies against anything. If they produce antibodies against the mild neural junction, the patient will present with myasthenia gravis. If they produce antibodies against C1 esterase, they can present with angioedema. So it depends on what they produce antibodies against. But anytime you have a patient with a lymphoma or leukemia, it's a B-cell disease, they can form antibodies against anything. So expect anything from pemphigoid to this. Anything is a possibility. So this is acquired C1 esterase deficiency. How do we know it's acquired? Well, we can check the C1 and C4. If it's a hereditary angioedema, patients had it long enough that they can keep up and make enough C1. Their C1s will be normal. If it's acquired, the C1 will be low. So therefore, the screening test has to be the C4 in order to differentiate the acquired from the congenital. Obviously, bradykinin is the culprit here. And that, of course, is why you get angioedema with ACE inhibitors. Okay, what's the reason for hypercalcemia in these patients? This is lupus perneal that was referred to by Dr. DiGiovanni. Lupus perneal involves the skin. What it is sarcoid. It just tells you that this patient with sarcoid has involvement of the liver and bone and chest. They'll have those typical potato nodes in the chest x-ray. In granulomatous disease, as you know, whether it's TB, histoplasmosis, brucellosis, whatever, any granulomatous disease can be associated with hypercalcemia because the granulomas make the 25-hydroxylase that activates vitamin D. Sorry, it's the one alpha hydroxylase that activates the vitamin D. So granulomatous diseases equal hypercalcemia. This patient has a tremor and a rash. You can tell by the mask face he's this patient with Parkinson's disease. In this case, it's associated with seborrheic dermatitis. You can see it around their nose. Seborrheic dermatitis is caused by Malathisia furfur or Pittycox formovaculare. Again, if you see seborrheic dermatitis, it's just one of the things to think about is Parkinson's disease. This man jammed his glasses on a door. He ends up with a ecchymosis. Of course, you could jam your glasses and end up with the same thing. However, this was a minor trauma producing ecchymosis. That means the blood vessels are fragile. Well, what's one reason blood vessels would be fragile? Maybe it's because the blood vessels are surrounded by amyloid, causing them to be fragile. In this case, amyloidosis. How else do we know? Because in amyloidosis, you get pinched purpura. You pinch the skin on the patient, and the patient will develop purpura in that area because of the fragile blood vessels. As you remember, you get small complexes with left axis deviation when amyloid involves the heart. You can tell from the tongue that there's been infiltration of the tissues, so this is one of the tip-offs to amyloid. This HIV patient is from Phoenix. Again, when you have HIV patients, you go by the locality. For Phoenix, you're thinking coccyx. And of course, in this case, it is. If you have another HIV patient, by the way, and let's say he's from Vancouver, Canada, or the Northwest, then you should consider Cryptococcus gatti, G-A-T-T-I. That's been reported in the literature over the past couple of years. It's fair game for the board. This is a patient with a disseminated candidiasis. Candida involves fingernails, as because, you know, if you don't have T cells working, candidiasis can involve any skin anywhere. And of course, this patient has systemic candidiasis, chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis. It can be associated with ectodermal dysplasia, as it was with Michael Berryman. Chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis is characterized, again, by T cell deficit. Therefore, B cells are hyperactive because the T cells are not working. So therefore, you're prone to autoimmune diseases. You start attacking your parathyroid glands, your adrenal glands. So you end up with chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis and autoimmune polyandrogen syndrome consisting of hypoparathyroidism and Addison's disease. You recognize the reticulated rash whenever you see this giraffe-type rash, especially when the patient exercises. In the presence of slapped cheeks, you know that's parvovirus B19. Parvovirus B19 is not the problem for the kid. It's a problem for the mother or father. They end up with arthralgias, encephalitis, or in this case, aplastic anemia. Photodermatitis, yes, it's been reconfirmed that you do get sparing of the nasolabial folds in lupus, so that still holds. That sparing of the nasolabial folds is obvious on this patient. This patient has SLE. This is a cocaine abuser. This has been referred to in prior lectures as well. The problem is they cut the cocaine with levamisole. Levamisole causes vascular thrombosis, and you can get the spontaneous thrombosis. Patients will present in the emergency room in this particular pattern, with this particular pattern. The lesion on the left is a pathogenic granuloma. The one in the middle is a carried away acanthoma, the basal cell carcinoma, you know, by the pearliness. Therefore, with that pyogenic granuloma, this looks the same as that pyogenic granuloma. This is bacillary angiomatosis, though, in an HIV patient. And, of course, that's due to Bartonella. Bartonella is one of those organisms that lives in the red blood cell. It's hard to get rid of it. This patient drinks well water. That should just trigger nitrate poisoning to you. So you're talking about methemoglobinemia. How do you tell? Well, once the methemoglobin is over 15%, the patient will present with cyanosis. And how do you tell? Well, they take it to the lab, mix it with oxygen. Once you get the oxygen in there, the blood will turn from chocolate brown to red. And, of course, that's one of the tip-offs. These people have that saturation gap where the pulse ox will come back low, whereas the arterial gas will come back to normal. So you get that saturation gap. That's a tip-off to methemoglobinemia, in this case due to the well water. You can get it leaching into the fields like for this farming operation. A lumpy jaw, this, of course, is actinomycosis israeli. Dr. Blackburn talked about it. He showed you the same slide, the one at the bottom. Lumpy jaw, of course, usually it's from dental caries, and the actinomyces grows, and you get this calcium and phosphate. Remember, once the calcium, with inflammation, you get elevation of calcium and phosphate. Once they reach 60, a problem of 60, it's prone to precipitate. And that's why, because of the marked inflammation, the precipitation of calcium phosphate, and that's what that red is. This is Sweet syndrome. You may or may not have heard about it. It's just neutrophils, white blood cells. In this case, they form this bob relief effect on the skin. Obviously, this can be associated with myelogenous leukemia since that consists of neutrophils. However, you can get it in a lot of other diseases. You can see the associations there. I do recommend you go through. I'm not covering everything on these slides. I recommend you go through them because there's a lot of pearls that I have written down for you. And in any way, Sweet syndrome is marked by pathergy. Whenever you stick a needle in the skin and you get a result, you get a pustule. The classic is Behçet's syndrome. It occurs in a lot of diseases. I've listed some of them there. These are all characterized by pathergy. Every one of these, this is the complete list of all the diseases characterized by pathergy. You can run through that yourself. Notice disseminated gonococcemia, you can have pathergy. This is a patient with porphyria cutanea tarda. The reason for that is that one of the liver enzymes is sensitive to in terms of deactivation or inflammation is hepatic uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase, HUD. deficiency. Pedicuro, I can never say it right. But anyways, it's a dehydrogenase enzyme that's sensitive. Well, what happens if you deactivate that enzyme? Well, you end up with porphyrin products. The particular porphyrin products that are backed up because of this uroporphyrinogen decarboxylase deficiency are deposited in the skin, creates porphyria cutanea tarda. And that's where you get this kind of scarring of the skin. It looks like the guy's a mechanic, and he's been doing a lot of work, the guy or lady involved. They also get hypertrichosis. They get increased hair in the temporal region. Those tips off this disease. It can be a drug associated as well. We'll talk about that later. Whenever you consider porphyria, don't forget that acute intermittent porphyria, though it's not, in this case, the porphyrin product that's backed up does not deposit in the skin. It deposits in the nervous system, and the backup is porphobilinogen, as you remember, in acute intermittent porphyria. Remember, those patients who come in with abdominal pain to the ER, all the workup is negative. It's because nobody thinks about checking the porphobilinogen for backed up products of porphyrin metabolism. So they obviously present with psychosis, neuropathies, paresthesias. Another characteristic is hyponatremia because, again, it's CNS involvement, so they get inappropriate ADH secretion. It flares up during the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle. It also can be precipitated by a low-carbohydrate diet. Every one of those can be a key in the question that this is acute intermittent porphyria. Just don't forget it because it's not lectured on that much. Anybody with nosebleeds and GI bleeding should be considered for hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia. There was a recent case in the New England Journal. If you're smart enough to read the New England Journal CPC every week, you read this case. If you don't read it every week, you should take the time to read it every week. They have AV malformations everywhere. In order to make the diagnosis, of course, there has to be a family history. You can't just have telangiectasia. But if they do have telangiectasia, like the recent case in the New England Journal involved the liver, this patient actually had a high output cardiac failure because of the AV malformations. It was so big. Of course, it can occur in the brain. AV malformations can occur on the chest x-ray, so they may get the case with a coin lesion on the chest x-ray, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia, or they can present with a stroke or CNS changes. These are the diseases characterized by telangiectasia. Sometimes you don't think about these. Obviously, hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia is one of those. Kress syndrome, you know. Carcinoid, you know. Ataxia telangiectasia, we've talked about. So there could be a lot of questions that have to do with telangiectasia. This man has chondritis involving the ear. He has also uveitis involving the eye. Whenever you get that combination, you should think of relapsing polychondritis. It's actually one of the IgG4-related diseases. As you know, that's a recent entity. They may ask, and it's been around now for 4 or 5 years, IgG4-related disease. It usually presents as pancreatitis or retroperitoneal fibrosis, but it can, this is one of the variations it can present as, is relapsing polychondritis. They do get subglottic collapse of the cartilage, so they can present with stridor, just like Wegener's can present with stridor. Ulcers in the mouth. You have to have ulcers in the genital region and in the mouth. If you do, and they have uveitis, that's enough to define Behçet syndrome. Of course, they're usually Middle Eastern. That should tip you off to the case if they, in fact, would ever give you Behçet's. They may well give it because it's one of those rare diseases. It is a medium vessel vasculitis, by the way. This is acrodermatitis enteropathica due to zinc deficiency. Why is that important? Well, it's more important in the countries where the nutrition is poor. Again, it's related to a zinc deficiency. Why might that appear on the board? Because in a glucagonoma, you have the same type of rash because they have malabsorption with diarrhea. They do have zinc deficiency. So the rash looks just like enteropathica. That we just talked about, except in the case of a glucagonoma, it's called necrotitic migratory erythema, NME. That was referred to, I think, by Dr. Giovanni as well. But if you do get a glucagonoma, they're going to have diabetes, they're going to have alopecia, diarrhea, glossitis, anemia, DVTs. There's going to be a lot of other tip-offs besides the rash, but they'll almost always give you glossitis or the rash, and you'll know that that's a glucagonoma. Here's an AIDS patient from Cincinnati. Obviously, this is going to cause you to consider histoplasmosis. Oddly enough, pigeons do carry three diseases, histoplasmosis, and they give you an ocular histoplasmosis syndrome. It'd probably be on the ophthalmology boards, probably not on the internal medicine boards. Anyways, pigeons do carry the cryptococcus as well. Again, that's just something to be, you're already familiar with psittacosis and toxoplasmosis. Bob talked about, here are those curly hairs associated with perifollicular hemorrhage and gum hypertrophy, so this would help you to diagnose scurvy or vitamin C deficiency. Here's an HIV patient with, do I only have 5 minutes? Oh my word. Or maybe that's the first half hour. That's just the first half hour? Oh yeah, okay, thanks. Because I just keep rolling along here. Another HIV patient, of course, this is Kaposi's sarcoma. Remember, in the classic Kaposi's, the Mediterranean Kaposi's, it's usually in the feet. In the HIV patient, it's usually in the head or neck. And then in between, you have the African type. So you have the different types of Kaposi's sarcoma. As you know, this is human herpes type 8. The bottom fellow has HPV. And the top guy has leukoplakia. So the top's due to EB virus. The bottom there is due to HPV infection. That's not a good place to get it. Of course, that's associated with head and neck carcinoma. He's had his tongue somewhere he probably shouldn't have. This patient has Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. You get that melanosis. It's on the fingertips, on the lips. Why is that important? Because this is associated with cancer. It's one of those congenital things that is related to cancer. Usually, though, it's not colon cancer. It's more likely pancreatic or female-type cancers like endometriocarcinoma. Important to recognize, though, because they can get into subsection and melana. Again, Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. You want to screen the family. It's a hamartomatous syndrome. Cowden's disease, I'll skip. You're probably not going to see it. I've only had one case in 40-some years of practice. I shouldn't put it on there. I probably should take it up. But it is. It's asking some boards. I don't know if it'll be on ours. This pudorange of the skin is pseudoxanthoma elasticum. You may remember that. It's due to a ABCC6 binding cassette. It's a transport. A problem with a transport protein, so it ends up wrecking the collagen or the elastic tissue, makes the elastic tissue swell, calcify, and fragment. So you get these changes in the angioid streaks in the retina. The thing is, you get ripping of blood vessels as well, so you can get, because of that, because the blood vessel tears, it can calcify, and eventually you can occlude the blood vessels. So these patients will present eventually with intermittent claudication or even angina. It's more common to have intermittent claudication. It ends up being a vascular disease because the elastic tissue, of course, surrounds the blood vessels. So that's why you have the angioid streaks and the ischemic manifestations. Osteomas of the jaw, these are multiple sebaceous cysts. This is Gardner syndrome. You would expect the problem with the APZ, adenomatous polyposis carcinoma gene. As you know, these patients are treated with Celebrex in an attempt to prevent the carcinoma. This is neurofibromatosis type 2. These patients do not have coffee lace spots on the skin. They do not have neurofibromas on the skin. What you're seeing here is a schwannoma. And, of course, these patients are characterized by bilateral acoustic neuromas, which are now called bilateral schwannomas, but it's the same thing. That would be the reason to recognize this, because you're not really going to have the skin manifestations. This patient just tends to have one of the schwannomas on the skin. That's in contradistinction to neurofibromatosis type 1, of course, that has the dumbbell tumors in the spinal cord and the field chromocytomas. That's why they might give you a case like this. These patients will have the neurofibromas on the skin. They'll also have the Coffea-LA spots, and they'll have a crow's sign, which is axillary freckling. So these patients are more easily recognized than is the patient with type 2 neurofibromatosis. This probably won't be asked. I've got a mental block. What is this disease? Oh, shoot. This happens to me. The older I get, the more mental blocks I get. Tuberous sclerosis. Thank you. Thanks. Occasionally I need help. So this is tuberous sclerosis. These people can present in their teenage years. The tip-off is the cortical tubers, the chagrin patch, which is that mountain ash leaf patch, which we were all taught in medical school. They can have cardiac rhabdomyomas, so they could present with a tumor plop, as I've done in the stem of this case. Okay, the axillary freckling has been talked about, acanthosis nigricans, a part of the Hare-Ann syndrome. Originally, acanthosis nigricans was associated with gastric adenocarcinomas. That's pretty rare now to have that association. More commonly today, this is a manifestation of polycystic ovarian syndrome because you have increased androgen effects. Androgen end up being related to insulin resistance. So you have high insulin levels. Insulin's a growth factor, like insulin-like growth factor 1. So therefore, you get proliferation of the skin. But again, the whole thing is most often related to polycystic ovary syndrome. These patients usually have a characteristic shape resembling the Tasmanian devil. This patient with uncontrolled diabetes presents with an acute abdomen. You can see the eruptive xanthomas. Again, they're red surrounded by yellow. The yellow is triglycerides. Triglycerides are highly inflammatory. When triglycerides are in the skin, you have inflammation. You have the associated redness. When cholesterol's in the skin, you don't have the redness. Cholesterol's not that toxic. But triglycerides are highly toxic, so they'll produce the redness. I think I said that wrong. I think it's yellow deposit surrounded by red. I said it backwards. Of course, you have the lipemia retinalis. This would be a patient with type 1, 3, 4, or 5 hyperlipidemia, if you use the old classification. Of course, once the triglycerides over 500, then you're going to be worried about pancreatitis. This patient has Kaplan syndrome. It's rheumatoid nodules in the lung. If you have rheumatoid nodules, you're pretty much guaranteed to have positive rheumatoid factor. You're also pretty much guaranteed to have coronary artery disease. As you know, there's an association there. So the whole point of this question is that the patient goes to anesthesia. You're not to manipulate anybody's neck, as was just stated, because they may have C1, C2 involvement. The lesions, Dr. Blackburn covered this. The lesions that march up the lymphatics. If something's marching up the lymphatics, it's one of those four things. Mycobacterium barium, nocardia, sporticosis, or tularemia. The only one that would be an exception is somebody's over to the Middle East in the armed forces. They can get leishmaniasis, they can march. But generally in the U.S., it's going to be one of these four things. If you get lymphatics, they're showing progressive inflammation marching up or whatever leg or arm. It's got to be one of those four. This is a patient with leprosy. Of course, that involves the nerves. You get two types, lepromas and tuberculoid. I'm not going to take the time to talk about that, but it's better off to actually have the tuberculoid. With the lepromatous leprosy, you can have that syndrome that's characterized by erythema nodosum. So it might give you erythema nodosum with leprosy, so just be aware of that. Bilateral pneumonia with bullous meningitis, you know that from med school, that that's mycoplasma pneumonia. Now, this patient has characteristic target lesions. That's erythema multiforme. Now, in contradistinction to Stevens-Johnson syndrome and TEN, which can have targetoid-type lesions, when you see the pure target lesions, that's erythema multiforme, and that's usually an infection. Remember I said Stevens-Johnson and TEN is usually a drug. Okay, Erythema multiforme is usually an infection, in this case, mycoplasma. Mycoplasma is one of those causes of erythema multiforme. The other cause of erythema multiforme in terms of an infection is usually herpes simplex. So in this case, I've changed the stem to be a patient that has herpes simplex, yet the patient has erythema multiforme. The most common causes of erythema multiforme. Everything causes erythema multiforme, but I would be aware of the two common infections that cause it. Appalachian Trail here, of course, this would be Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. If you get a case where the rash starts on the ankles or on the scrotum, on the ankles or wrist, excuse me, or on the scrotum, and is spreading centrally, always be considering Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, which in this case has been called Carolina Spotless Fever, because that's a more accurate name for the disease, since it has nothing to do with the Rocky Mountains. And usually you're not fortunate enough to get the rash. So North Carolina Spotless Fever. These are the tick-related diseases. As Dr. Blackburn told you, I've underlined three that you're probably going to ask on the board. One is a spirochete, one is a protozoan, one is a bacteria. But the thing is, they're carried by the same tick. So you could theoretically have all three of these diseases at once. And he talked about that in terms of treating it for Lyme disease, but it may really be babesiosis or ehrlichiosis. Remember, the other name for ehrlichiosis is anaplasmosis. I've listed that there for you. Again, go over these slides. There's a lot of information that I'm not covering. Remember the tetrad forms, the Maltese forms of the babesiosis. This used to be called Nantucket fever. My roommate in college was from Nantucket. I kept wondering why it was different fevers. That was obviously a long time ago. This patient, this question is invariably missed. And I just, it beats me. I can't understand it. I teach this students and residents, and the case will come up, and they don't recognize it. I don't know why. Whenever you get a pustule associated with anything that looks like an infection, you got to be thinking gonococcus. And, of course, this is disseminated gonococcemia. So whenever you get a pustule in the presence of arthritis or tendinitis, that's the arthritis, arthritis syndrome of disseminated gonorrhea. So don't miss it. It's often asked on the board. Again, that'll be one of these pathogy cases. You could do a needle stick, you could get a pustule, because it's one of those things that's loaded with the neutrophils. Allegedly, you can actually culture the GC out of this. Of course, you would check that person for terminal complement deficiency, right? You've already been through that. This is vitiligo. We've already said, consider Hashimoto's thyroiditis and also consider Addison's disease. So in this particular case, I would have done an ACTH test on this patient. Obviously, if the ACTH was a cortisol below 18 or 20, that's a good sign of Addison's disease. Again, one of those multi-phase diseases, and you recognize, as I already told you, you're thinking spirochetes when it's multiphasic. In this case, syphilis, you have the typical copper, red, ham lesions on the extremities of the alopecia. Patch looks like pityriasis rosea. If you don't find the Herald patch on a patient, that may well be secondary syphilis. On the other hand, if you have pityriasis rosea, you should automatically do a VDRL on the patient. Remember, VDRL is used to screen. The definitive test is the ones that are listed there, the FTA absorption or the MHPTP, to make a definitive test. With treatment, of course, you're to follow the VDRL, not the MHATP, because it'll stay positive. So if you want to see if they're responding, follow the VDRL. This patient has a herpetic Whitlow. Generally, it's herpes 1. Obviously, it could be herpes 2. At any rate, it's a herpetic Whitlow. You're all familiar with that. It's why you wear gloves when you're examining patients. This, you can see a budding yeast here. This particular patient was from Wisconsin. In this case, blastomycosis. Remember, these fungal infections almost always come in through the lung. They're usually inhaled and then disseminate. They love to disseminate to the bones. They love to disseminate to the prostate. Adrenals, there's different places where these funguses tend to disseminate. A portal of entry, I think I said that wrong. The portal of entry in this case is the skin and then disseminates. Either way, whether it's skin or inhalation, you can get dissemination. That's the point. These are the budding yeast you should be aware of, the blastomycosis, the histol, and the sporal. Usually it's spherial to its cocci, so that's not as obvious on the slide. What about chemical abnormality do you expect in these patients? Well, this is granuloma annulare. If you're lucky, you get that circular thing like the picture in the middle is showing you, and also the hand on the left. It can be disseminated. You can have a disseminated granuloma annulare. It is associated with hyperlipidemia. So if they give you a case like that, the first thing I would think of is hyperlipidemia, although some people say diabetes. This is scleroderma. Obviously, SCL7 is one of those extractable nuclear antigens that's always asked, almost always asked on the board, is typoisomerase 1 or 3. Whenever you have typoisomerase in the presence of scleroderma, you almost always have the pulmonary fibrosis. The other one that I've seen asked is anti-RNP polymerase 3. That just means that they have renal involvement with the scleroderma. As you know, the thing that kills you in scleroderma is the renal involvement. Of course, since ACE inhibitors, we can save those patients now. This is just another slide showing anti-polymerase 3 in scleroderma being related to the renal involvement. The criteria for rheumatoid arthritis, Dr. DiGiovanni went over it. Remember, rheumatoid arthritis involves the ulnar aspect of the wrist. Osteoarthritis involves the radial aspect of the wrist. That's really all that slide is saying. He's already discussed how you make the diagnosis. They have to have it for 6 weeks, et cetera. There's the criteria. I'll skip over that. Here's a patient with this extruding calcium from the digits. Whenever anybody extrudes calcium from the digits, it has to be dermatomyositis or scleroderma. Those are the only two things I'll take that back. There are other things that'll do it, like chronic dialysis patients and so forth, where they get calciphylaxis. But generally, you're going to consider the two collagen vascular diseases. What else would this patient have besides that, the Raynaud's and the sclerodactyly? Well, they'd have telangiectasia. Again, that scleroderma is one of those telangiectatic diseases. Cat bite, you know, is Pastorella multicida. Saltwater fisherman, as Dr. Blackburn said, this is Vibrio fulnificus. Vibrio loves iron. It's one of those iron-loving or siderophilic bacteria. That's why they die of the Vibrio, because these patients usually have high iron deposits in their cirrhotic livers. There are particular bacteria that love iron, and this is one of them. 5 days, you may occasionally see this as a pediatric question, of course, strawberry tongue. Strawberry tongue is usually either toxic shock syndrome, throat, or Kawasaki's disease, in this case, Kawasaki disease. But you have to have the other five things: acral involvement with edema, the conjunctivitis, and the disseminated rash, along with adenopathy. If you have those five things, you have Kawasaki disease. They can present in the teenage years with, of course, the coronary artery aneurysms. That's why all those radio ads have you look for Kawasaki's disease. This is a farmer. He's on Prograf. He's immunosuppressed, and lo and behold, he's picked up nocardia, and the nocardia has disseminated to the lung. Whenever you get a lung abscess, it goes to the brain. As was pointed out by Dr. Blackburn, you consider tuberculosis, nocardiosis, or anaerobic infections. Those are the three lung abscesses that metastasize to the brain. This is the Shaw sign that was discussed along with Grotten's papules and the mechanic's hands, which is roughening of the skin on the radial side of the fingers. Anti-P155, that should not be on the internal medicine boards. That's the one that's associated with malignancy. Anyways, the Shaw sign and the Gottron's papules, you should recognize that. It is on that slide, though, the P155. So sometimes, I suppose they could ask it, but These are xanthomas. They're not really eruptive xanthomas. These are tuberous xanthomas. Of course, it's classic for your type 2 hyperlipidemia that's associated with coronary artery disease. These are tendon xanthomas, same thing. Tendon xanthomas or tuberous xanthomas, either one, associated with coronary artery disease. And of course, their problem is that they don't have the LDL receptor in the liver. Of course, that's the basis for the new PCSK9 medications. They increase the LDL receptors in the liver. Seizures and proteinuria on this particular patient. Well, the patient has these painless oral lesions. That's wrong. I put aphthous ulcer on there. Aphthous ulcers are by definition painful, so that's really shouldn't be on there. So if you get a chance, just scratch out aphthous because they're painless. They're painless oral lesions characteristic of lupus. If they're painful, that usually is an aphthous ulcer. You can see the discoid alae here. Notice the rash is not on the knuckles. The rash is in between the knuckles. Anyways, when you add this whole thing up, this is ends up being lupus. Here's uric acid. This was also discussed. I don't think I'll go through this slide. Obviously, the needle-shaped crystal is yellow when it's parallel to the compensator as an indication of uric acid. It's blue if it's pseudogout or calcium pyrophosphate, which this is. This is calcium pyrophosphate. Again, you get the calcification of the knee cartilage, which is showing up here. The crystal is more rhomboid shape, and it's blue. The thing to worry about, of course, is the neck. They do get a crown dens. They get in pseudogout or calcium pyrophosphate deposition disease. They can have neck pain. These are the digits, the sausage digits, in this case, the opera glass hand, as it's called, pencil and cup deformity of psoriatic arthritis. As you know, there's those five types of psoriatic arthritis. This, of course, is the worst one. This is the one you don't want. This is a case with antibodies to the synthesase or anti-JO1 antibodies. This is the other extractable nuclear antigen that you will probably be asked. You need to be familiar with the anti-synthesase syndrome because it is associated with dermatomyositis and lung involvement. So they'll also have the pulmonary fibrosis, just like the scleroderma patient with the antibodies that we discussed earlier would also tend to have pulmonary involvement with pulmonary fibrosis. These are actually amino acyl transfer RNA synthetase, but it's an anti-synthetase syndrome. You may see that rather than anti-JO1. And you can see, I put it on that slide, it's the same thing. Okay, clubbing of the fingernails, it turns out it's due to platelet-derived growth factor. Obviously, if there's pulmonary osteodystrophy, if you get increased bone overgrowth, there has to be a growth factor involved. So in the case of lung cancers, AV shunts, and so forth, you can get clubbing. So clubbing should tip you off to any of those things that I've listed. They feel like the platelet-derived growth factor is more involved than the other growth factors. Obviously, hyperthyroidism can stimulate clubbing as well. Here's a patient with fingernail involvement. You really couldn't tell this from a dermatophyte, except for the fact that I've indicated that this patient would tend to have any of these changes. And the oil drops, that oil drop change on the lower left should make you consider psoriasis. So in fact, this is psoriasis. All three of those patients have psoriatic involvement of the nails. Again, why do we want to know about psoriasis? Well, because of the association with coronary disease. Splinter hemorrhages, of course, can be due to anything that's listed. Trauma is the most common cause of splinter hemorrhage, not endocarditis. Anyways, the list of splinter hemorrhages are there. Here's a change in the nail called a half and half nail. This was classically called Lindsay's nail, and we'd see it in renal failure. There's also a Terry's nail that's associated with cirrhosis of the liver. But again, half and half nails, usually it indicates liver or renal involvement. I think that's what you need to take home. The Mies lines, Scott already talked about that, and this you would always consider. I'm sorry, these are Bohs lines. Bohs lines are actually a dystrophic change in the nail. Mies lines, you don't really have a dystrophic change. It's usually a color change. Mies lines are actually a crease. You can kind of see the crease, the dystrophic change. That's compatible with Bohs lines. Bohs lines indicate some metabolic process that shut down the nail growth rather than a color change that's due to the heavy metal. So the color change is Mies lines. Sorry to mix you up here. The color change is Mies lines. The actual dystrophic change would be Bohs lines. So there was something that interrupted the patient's metabolism, such as a myocardial infarction or pneumonia. Here's arsenic. Again, it's already, Scott already talked about it, and you can see that's the same kind of nail change. We'll skip over that. This is Bowen's disease of the skin. It's a squamous cell carcinoma in situ. It is caused by everything that's listed there, except alcohol doesn't cause it. But arsenic does cause it. It's another thing arsenic can cause. UV light causes it. The AIDS virus causes it. So does the papilloma virus. Again, it's a squamous cell carcinoma in situ. It's called Bowen's disease. It's characterized by windblown keratocytes. Those keratocytes are changing because of the malignancy, and that's why they call it windblown. There's a big change in the skin. It's the same thing as erythroplasia for a rat. Notice there's multiple changes here. This is not a color change. It's actually edema. Those are episodes of edema, and that's called Merkel's nail, and that's associated with nephrotic syndrome. Because in nephrotic syndrome, the patients swell. So you can theoretically get past this. You just have to recognize really color changes. It's points of edema where the patient was undergoing a flare-up of his nephrotic syndrome. Here's a nail change where you have a fungus involving the proximal nail. Now, fungus, anytime you get a dermatophyte or onychomycosis, it should come in from the outside. It should come in from the nail edge on the outside, not be proximally located. If it's located proximally, that's abnormal. So if you have a fungal infection in the proximal area, you should be thinking HIV. Anytime an infection presents atypically, you're supposed to consider HIV. Okay, yellow nail syndrome, of course, if you see yellow nails, you're automatically going to think lymphedema, some pulmonary problem, especially bronchiectasis. So connect yellow nails to bronchiectasis or cough. Spoon nails are not always Plummer-Vinson syndrome with iron deficiency that you learned in school. It may also be due to deficiency of methionine or cysteine, the amino acids. Here's a patient with hyperpigmentation. AZT is one of the things you would consider. Today, it would be more like the amiodarone. Don't forget that phototerminitis is usually due to Lyme's. Paget's disease of the breast. That is, in fact, intraepithelial adenocarcinoma. They probably have ductal carcinoma. You got to be careful. You can get an eczema that would look like this. I think I wouldn't wait. I would go ahead and send this patient to be biopsied. Swimming pool folliculitis you already know is Pseudomonas, but remember there's other kinds of folliculitis. Don't forget eosinophilic folliculitis that I put in red because that's the one they're liable to ask you because that's the one associated with HIV, the eosinophilic folliculitis. You can have all those other ones. I won't take the time to discuss those. You can read it. Vancomycin does give you the red man syndrome. It also can give you another rash called IgA bullous dermatitis. I don't expect they ever ask this, but vancomycin can have two different rashes, one the flushing and one this string of pearls phenomenon. This is dermatitis herpetiformis associated with celiac disease. As you were lectured on yesterday, these patients, of course, can have tissue transglutaminase antibodies. You can have IgA deficiency. I think they mentioned that yesterday. So in that case, you would order an IgG tissue transglutaminase level to differentiate it. Because the IgA will be positive if the patient's obviously IgA deficient. Their lesions look herpetic, and of course, that's why this is called dermatitis herpetiformis. Again, it's IgA in the skin. Don't forget the mahi-mahi, where you get the headache, nausea, abdominal cramping, and flushing. That's because these particular fish, the mackerel, the tuna, and especially the mahi-mahi, are dark, dark meat. That dark meat has histidine. The bacteria work on the histidine to create it, to transform it to histamine. Therefore, these patients eat their meal and they end up flushing. And that, of course, is different from the Ciguatera fish poisoning, which is due to the dinoflagellates that produce the red tide in the oceans. People eat fish that have eaten this red tide organism, the dinoflagellate, and they end up with the Ciguatera fish poisoning. How do you tell that from that histamine poisoning? Well, the difference is when you have the histamine poisoning, you have the nausea and vomiting, but you do not get the ataxia. You don't get the central nervous system involvement. You do with these dinoflagellates. You get the ataxia and those other CNS changes or paresthesias, as Dr. Blackburn said. They can't tell hot from cold. Everything cold feels hot, etc. So don't forget those two different kind of fish poisonings. They're obviously different. We should mention the Fuju puffer fish. That's a tetrodotoxin. That also gives you central nervous involvement. And of course, the worst part of that is you quit breathing and die at the restaurant. Parapsoriasis, if you have a stage where this patient presents with kind of an eczema and goes on to this patch, plaque, and tumor, that's a typical progression for this cutaneous, in this case, T-cell lymphoma that can lead to the Sézary syndrome. This is mycosis fungoides, of course. This is subacute cutaneous SLE. Why do they ask it on the board? Well, because if it's a woman and she has a baby, the baby can have heart block because of the anti-Ro, anti-La antibodies that are associated with this particular skin rash. So kind of important to recognize it as subacute cutaneous SLE for that reason. A patient with multiple seborrheic keratosis, that's a sign of Lacerte-Trelet. The problem is, if this develops suddenly, it can be associated with visceral malignancies. Here's a patient with rose spots. Just know that during one of the stages of typhoid fever, the patient can get these rose spots. Don't forget to differentiate the typhoid fever, the Salmonella typhoidium, from the other Salmonella that we get from Tyson chicken and the chickens that are not free range. I love that slide of the free range chicken that Dr. Blackburn showed. Just bearded dragons, of course, are another source of that particular Salmonella. You don't treat the Salmonella enterites, the ones that you get with the food poisoning, because it can prolong the excretion of the organism. In typhoid fever, he said you don't treat it, but I think if it's like typhoid Mary, you probably should treat it, because they can have not only gallbladder abscesses, they can have abscesses literally anywhere in the body with the typhoid. This man had a bee sting, 10 minutes ago. Of course, this is a type 1 IgE reaction, as has already been talked about. And yes, anxiety can cause mast cell degranulation. So nerves can cause urticaria. And you can see that CRH, I've shown, is one of the hormones that actually can activate corticotropin release. Hormone can activate the mast cells. So you can, in fact, get urticaria from stress. Here's a toxic, staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome. How do you tell that from streptococcal? Since they both have, theoretically, a sandpaper-type rash. Well, as was pointed out by Dr. Blackburn, if it's staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome, blood cultures are usually negative. In order to make the diagnosis of streptococcal toxic shock syndrome, you would need a positive blood culture for streptococcus. So this patient could have a tampon in place or have a nasal packing in place, and the staph may not be obvious, but it is associated with those particular foreign objects that are in place. Not that you couldn't get it from some of another staph infection. But you do have to have three organ system involvements to diagnose staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome, and that's the basis of putting E as the answer, diarrhea, ALT, and CPK. So there's three different organ systems involved here. So this is, by definition, staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome. This is different. The toxin here from the staph is different. In this case, it's an exfoliotoxin, not the toxin that causes staphylococcal toxic shock syndrome. That's a different toxin from the staphylococcus. The point is here, if you have a patient with scalded skin syndrome, yes, that's usually a pediatric patient, but it can occur in an immunosuppressed elderly patient or a typical patient that you might see in the hospital. And their skin lesion, that toxin has caused exfoliation in the upper granular layer of the skin. And on biopsy, you can't tell this from pemphigus. It looks just like pemphigus. Excuse my explosive speech. That's associated with some kind of a syndrome. Here's a patient, in fact, that has pemphigus. Remember, pemphigus is due to an antibody against the material that adheres the granular layer skin cells together. And when you get an antibody formed against that, in this case it's called desmoglein, but when you get an antibody formed against that, it makes the skin cells split apart. So here it is up in the upper granular layer of the skin. You have a lesion that looks just like staphylococcal scalded skin syndrome, except in this case it's not due to the staphylococcal toxin, it's due to an antibody. Well, why did this patient get that antibody? Well, because he's got abnormal B cells, as I said. Anybody with lymphoma or leukemia can develop any abnormal B cell function with development of antibodies against anything. In this case, it was against the desmoglein, so he presented with pemphigus. Okay, this is just showing you that if somebody does have pityriasis rosea with a Herald spot, you should check them for syphilis. We'll skip that slide. It just shows that there are different kinds of skin reactions. I got 10 seconds. I want to say one thing in this 10 seconds. Look at that second column. It says DRESS, D-R-E-S-S syndrome. The next one is SJS and 10. And the next one is acute generalized exanthomatous pustulosis. That's at AGEP. I just want to say, in closing, that DRESS syndrome's incubation period is usually a month or more. So if they give you one of these cases, and you don't know whether it's DRESS, Steven Johnson, or this acute generalized exanthomatous pustulosis, look at the time since they started their medication. If it's a month or more, it's probably DRESS syndrome. They should have eosinophilia. If it's 2 to 3 weeks, it's probably Steven Johnson's TEN. If it's just 2 or 3 days, that's the acute generalized exanthomatous pustulosis. I didn't have time to finish the slides. Finish them yourself. They're all, I think, pointing to some question you could see on the board. Thank you.